You're listening to music by Cuban rap artists Orishas. I'm Sari Gameta, sitting in for Dime Roberts, and this is Stage and Studio. Richard Blanco is probably best known for being the inaugural poet at President Obama's second inauguration. He was the first immigrant, first Latino, first openly gay, and youngest poet in that position. He recently published his memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. While Richard Blanco is best known for his poetry, and especially his inaugural poem, One Today, he is also a civil engineer, and this memoir was a new experience in writing prose. During the Christmas holidays, he joined me by phone from his Miami childhood home, in the wake of President Obama's announcement about the potential for ending the Cuban embargo. We began our conversation with his memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos. What prompted you to write this memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, at this point?
Well, I actually started writing about 4 years ago, or maybe five now, before any news from the White House about the inauguration, about any of that. And I just started off sort of the way I started writing poetry, in the same sense. I was just following my creative curiosity. I wanted to see what it was like, what my life looked like in prose, what dimensions it would take on, and I just started fooling around. I also felt that there were so much backstory in some of the poetry. I mean, by then I had three books of poetry, and there's so many backstories and other sort of dimensions of narratives and things that I was never able to fit into a poem for some reason, and I was curious if that would come out in memoir, and it certainly did. It's not easy to write a poem about easy cheese, but in prose you can really get away with it.
I also wanted you to tell us a little bit about how the community of El Cocuyito and how they shaped who you are today.
Well, it's very interesting because, I mean, that's really a big part of the motivation of the book, and of course the book is named El Cocuyito because of the impact that store, and by that we mean, of course, the human beings in that store, the employees and the regulars, the groupies, as I call them, that would go to the store 2-3 times a day, the family that would always swing by the store, and the family members that worked there with me I ended up working there for quite several years. But how they shaped me was because I think there's this misunderstanding, or at least it's been my experience, and as the memoir takes, you know, it's a coming of cultural age story in a way too, right? Well, that's the primary sort of thread, along with dimensions of sexuality and artistic identity and whatnot. But the idea is that all these stories happen together, and in my case, becoming sort of, we don't grow up, at least I didn't grow up like loving being Cuban. You know, anything that my parents stood for was immediately tacky and grounds for rejection because it was just your parents. It's a generational thing. It was, you know, it's like kind of like if they're listening to salsa, well, you know, we're listening to AC/DC, you know. There's always an initial, oh my God, my parents are so tacky, they don't know English. And I've gotten some slack for saying that, but, you know, and I don't think it's everybody's experience, but certainly I think there's a dimension to that. Your parents, no matter what, are different, you know. Mm-hmm. And really, it's not that you rejected your culture, it's just you weren't ready to sort of really absorb and take it all in. And sort of that all happened at El Cocuyito, and meeting people and adding really real dimensions and faces and stories and realizing these aren't my parents just blathering about this or that or Cuba, but, you know, here's Rosario or here's Vicente or here's et cetera, these customers that would share their lives with me. And then just being able to be old enough and mature enough to realize, hey, wait a minute, this is a really important part of me and a very wonderful part of me. And really coming into my own in that sense and opening that door of understanding who I am culturally leads to also opening up the door of understanding a little bit more of who I am in terms of my sexuality and in terms of my artistic identity. And what I became interested in the book was sort of how all these things sort of are wrapped up together, how they all happen at the same time, because dimensions of becoming aren't strictly, you know, related just to a cultural identity, but there's so many dimensions and facets of what becoming means. And it's something that is perpetual, I think. We don't ever stop becoming as human beings, right? It's like this mirage that's always right in front of us. And just when we think we know who we are, it slips a few feet away, a few yards away from us. And we keep on sort of, in a way, chasing after who we are, our lives, who we already are. And the book ends at 17 because I think that's one of those moments when you almost feel like you caught up with your mirage. And then you graduate from high school, page turns, and oh boy, here comes a whole new world. And I knew I had to end the book there because there's no way that would be like, you know, the mirage slipping further away. That's another, sort of begins another narrative. But anyway, they were very significant in the ways of all these people, you know, how we learn to take the old adage of it takes a village, which is basically what the title of the book is playing off of. The
absolutely.
Prince of Los Cucuyos, meaning the prince, the village, you know, it becomes sort of, I'm reared by these people in a way. They're my people and I'm theirs, you know, kind of feeling. And it's this idea that each chapter is organized, really, if you look at it, around one particular relationship that was really important in my life, one particular person, and that all these people are responsible in a way for raising you, and that each one of them added and contributed something significant that is still with me to this day and moved me forward in a significant way, opened my life, opened my eyes, opened my heart to another dimension of myself that was always there, but sort of you need someone to bring that up.
She agreed and left the circular on the kitchen counter instead of tossing it out with the rest of the junk mail that came in English. Few things intimidated Abuela. Among these were black magic, Santeria, and Americanos. As for Americanos, Abuela wouldn't go anywhere she perceived to be wholly American, at least not alone. This included the Social Security office downtown, any restaurant with English-only menus, even Kim's Chinese Palace, fancy department stores like Burdine's, and most definitely not Winn-Dixie. But Abuela also couldn't resist a bargain. The following week, the chicken appeared in the mail at 26 cents per pound, 3 cents cheaper than the week before, and then 24 cents the week after that. The fryers haunted Abuela. Her stinginess slowly overcame her fear of Americanos until finally she broke. "Mijo, will you go with me shopping at Winn-Dixie mañana?" she half-asked, half-commanded. "Of course, Abuela. No te preocupes. I'll go with you." Soon, I dreamed our pantry would be stocked with crunch berry cereal and Oreo cookies, our freezer stuffed with Swanson TV dinners and Eskimo pies, our fridge filled with Hawaiian punch and American cheese. The next day after school, Abuela instructed Abuelo to drive to El Winn-Dixie instead of La Caridad. A gigantic red neon sign marked its entrance, the letters spelling out Winn-Dixie, the beef people, seeming to glow even in the daylight. "What does the beef people mean?" Abuela questioned me. I struggled for a translation that would make sense, but none did. "La gente de carne," I finally offered. "Cómo? How could that be?" Abuela said, perplexed by the thought of people made of meat, which is what my literal translation meant in Spanish.
That was Richard Blanco reading from his memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, at the Chicago Humanities Festival.
You were talking about language, and I had some questions about that. The really delightful part of your book is that it's written from a bilingual perspective. There are many aspects of Spanish that are influenced in your writing in the book, and this felt like a natural instinct, but I was curious, when did this kind of style emerge in your writing?
Well, I think as early, you know, from the very first poem, from the very first book, there's that sense of bringing in another language because that's the way I hear the world, right? And there's two things to that. One is the authenticity of, you know, I don't hear my parents or grandparents in English because they didn't speak English to me. So there's something about the echo of that in my mind that makes it to the page. And then it's this very sort of simple sound device, really, if you come to think of it. If I were to write a poem about my Cuban family, you know, eating pork on Thanksgiving, as is that first poem in the first book, when I throw in a little Spanish in there, whether you know what they're saying or not, suddenly you're in the room, right? It's a dimension of those characters. With prose, it was especially difficult because in poetry, I don't have that much dialogue, and the other characters don't speak as much. I mean, I'm basically, you know, the 98% of the narration is me. And with the memoir in particular, something I really had to play a lot with, because, you know, my mother and grandparents and father are speaking extensively in there. Again, what they said, I remember it in Spanish, not in English. And I tried several things, and one of the ones let them speak in English, but with a really thick accent, and sort of show that phonetically on the page. And I really liked that at first. But the first time I read that out loud, I was like, oh my God, my parents sound like buffoons. Really, really bad. I mean, and so it's really interesting, and maybe really study how language is perceived, and how, you know, my parents were pretty darn smart people, you know, and yet speaking bad English, they sounded like really dumb people, but they weren't. So in the end, I decided they would say certain words always in Spanish to give it again that sound bite. And what I played was more was with the syntax, right? So a non-native speaker will invert syntax sometimes and things like that, but it doesn't sound sort of dumb, but rather it just sounds a little bit different to the ear. So the speech, the patterns of speech are a little bit different. And so that's kind of what I was able to find and be happy with. And at the end of the day, I've always written in the sense of including Spanish, but not that it is for the monolingual reader. If you get the Spanish, if you're bilingual, you get a little bit more out of it. But I always write with the idea that even if you don't understand what's being said in Spanish, that it's not crucial to the critical understanding of the book, because at the end of the day, I see myself as someone, as an American English writer writing, and it just happens to be that this is sort of a reflection. This is part of the color of what I'm offering, right? In the same way that I would, if I were writing about living somewhere in New York, people would have a New York accent or something like that.
Yeah. Right. And that was a very important point to make, that, you know, everybody has this intelligence that often is not seen once you add another language without fluency in it. And that is how people perceive each other, unfortunately. So I appreciate that you talked a lot about that.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm guest host and producer Sari Gametta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. If you missed any of this show, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. Today we're featuring inaugural poet Richard Blanco and his recently published memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood.
And actually, I was curious how your family and the community that you grew up with, have they had a chance to read your book, and how have they responded?
Well, so far, again, it was a language issue, because the older generation, you know, doesn't, I mean, my mom knows, has a working knowledge of English, but, and I'm dying to get an offer for the book to be translated into Spanish, because, I mean, that's a sidebar. It's really interesting to me how in America we depend on other, in Spanish, to have other foreign publishers translate and publish the work, when there's such a huge sort of Spanish language speaking population right here in America. But anyway, I hope it'll get translated. But so the reaction hasn't been it's been all right.
It's been on hold
because I haven't read it. But my cousins certainly speak English, of course, and they've adored it. So, you know, it's really interesting when you write as a memoirist, you're really hypersensitive about every little thing, and you're thinking, oh my God, they're gonna say this about that, and they're gonna not like that I said that, or they're gonna question this or question that. And really, I think people end up being just so honored that they're even included in your work. And it's interesting also about memory, how they just remember things now the way you remember them. So that's been interesting to watch. And then there was also what was concerned besides family was, you know, in the memoir, the city, I wanted the city to be very much a character, in the sense of the subtitle is A Miami Childhood. And so I think I was writing also with the ghost of the entire of Miami, you know, the people that grew up during those years that I grew up, and I was concerned that people would say something, or, you know, call me on something that I just totally missed, or like say that wasn't on that corner, it was on this corner. You know how people get very possessive of things. And so far everybody just has loved the book for what it is, and not sort of gotten into that whole realm of you know, debating factoids or anything like that.
Wonderful. And speaking of the old neighborhood and your childhood in Miami, the title comes from the store you worked at, El Cocuyito.
Right.
I was wondering, is that store still in business? Are the folks you used to work with still around?
Yeah, the store is still around, except it's not owned by my uncle anymore. So that was another sort of point of contention. But yeah, it's still, I have never gone back inside since, I think it was probably maybe 7 years ago or something, maybe eight. My uncle sold the store. And so I've never dared to go back inside. Maybe that's memoir number five. But they say it's exactly the same. But there's something about like that. I just cannot go back in there. But it's also the idea of the grocery store. You know, there's many grocery stores of this kind. You know, La Bodega. And so it's about also creating that sensibility. So everyone had a store like that around them or where they went to in Miami with their grandparents. And it's iconic in my emotional life, certainly, but I think there are mirrors of that in everybody's sort of childhood in Miami in that sense, too.
And I, of course, can't let you go without asking you about Cuba and maybe your sentiments or voices from the community. Obviously, we have some timely news of the president negotiating talks with Cuba, lifting the embargo and travel restrictions. Of course, some of these things depend on
the latest news and all that. You know, right. It's funny, I just came from Miami and I was expecting this to be the buzz of the town. And I was like, I thought everybody was going to talk to me about it and family members. And sort of, but it was kind of like quiet, like nothing had ever happened.
Oh, really?
it's really interesting in some ways how I'm still letting it all sink in. But I think there's several interesting dimensions to that. The Cuban community is still old, new, and in between, you know, all generations are sort of like sort of waiting to let that sink in to see what this really means. And so I think they don't know quite what to say. I think it's also been so many years, and I think they don't want to get their hopes up high on one end, and the other hand, they don't want to get really angry either, because this might not lead to any kind of significant change in relations in the way that they see as it is now. So I think the community is still negotiating around it, and so am I. One thing I have sort of, I think, made up my mind about, and one thing where I think that I can help, and I can sort of help bring us to a new place, is this idea to, one, I think it seems like it's my generation's charge, or we're being handed the baton to say, okay, obviously we need some kind of change, but it's up to us to make sure that that change perhaps gets effected in the ways that our parents always hope the changes in, so we can sip mojito-flavored lattes in Starbucks. And I think America really, really needs to get that right. You know, this idea of opening up Cuba, we can't lose sight that the motive is about creating real changes in Cuba in terms of freedom and personal prosperity for the people. And, I mean, we can write a book about that. And I think it's easy to lose perspective, even for me and my generation, to sort of, oh, yeah, let's go to Cuba for the weekend and this kind of stuff. So I think that I felt like maybe that's something that our generation can take on and, in a way, honor our parents, but move things forward a little bit in a way that perhaps they couldn't emotionally. And then the other thing is there's a lot of stories to be told. You know, there's a lot of reconciliation of what I call the emotional embargo, because it has been, in a way, a family divided. Not that we have been completely, we do communicate, and I've been to Cuba 5-6 times and all this stuff, but still there's an emotional sort of divide and a little bit of emotional bridge building, or addressing that emotional embargo in some way. And I'd love to be the facilitator for that, to have us all tell our stories generationally. What are our greatest hopes for Cuba if these changes, things indeed start changing? What do we think Cuba will look like, and our relationship with them as cousins and nieces and nephews and aunts and uncles and family members, as community, as artist to artist? This is where the storytellers can really come in. And I'm talking on both sides of the 90 miles, right? So it's this fascination that I grew up sort of fascinated and mystified by looking at photos, black and white photos of my cousins, letters that would come in with strange stamps from another country, stories that my mother would tell me here and there in tidbits, and always thinking about, God, I wonder what my life would have been like if my parents had never left Cuba. And after I finally, in my 20s, went to Cuba for the first time, I realized my cousins shared with me the same sort of mystique, and sort of they would get color photographs of us, and they would think, oh my God, what kind of life would we have had if we lived in the United States? And so I think there's a lot of storytelling, and not just for the sake of healing, though that's a big part of it, but just to sort of understand, if 20 years from now, if we all claim to call ourselves Cuban, well, what does that mean? And how do all those varied experiences form one people again in some ways, if that makes sense? And that, there's been 50 years now, and my parents don't feel any less Cuban than the Cubans in Cuba. Even though they've lived here, that's where they grew up. So how do we address that emotional embargo and say, like, that's the part that politicians and policy and media can't even begin to address. It's not their job to address, but I think it's a big part of how we move forward on a sort of the right emotional foot, if you will.
Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, America, one today. One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes, spreading a simple truth across the Great Plains, then charging across the Rockies. One light, waking up rooftops, under each one a story, told by our silent gestures moving across windows. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. The penciled yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges arrayed like rainbows, begging our praise. Silver trucks heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us on our way to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry, or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem for all of us today.
That was Richard Blanco reading his inaugural poem, One Today, at President Obama's second inauguration. This was a recording from the PBS NewsHour.
I don't want to leave the interview without talking, of course, about your experience as being the inaugural poet laureate at President Obama's second inauguration. You were the first openly gay, first Latino, first immigrant, the youngest. I mean, that's a lot of firsts wear in that position. Tell us all about the experience.
Oh, it's just been, I mean, you can imagine so many different dimensions. Life-changing from in every single aspect you can imagine. But if I had to boil it down to one really major thing, this is in the little, what I call the little inaugural memoir, the memoirette, which came out about a year ago in November. It's all about the inaugural poet's journey. And I almost had to write that book just to be able to digest everything that happened. But if I had to boil it down to one thing, well, the most significant part of it all was that in some ways, at the time where I was 44, there's still some part of me that thought, well, I'm not really American. I'm not quite Peter Brady or Marsha Brady, or I'm not quite the Beaver. And just sitting there waiting to read the poem on the platform, it just dawned on me that my story, my mother's story, a woman who grew up in a dirt floor home in Cuba, the story of all of those 850,000 people on the National Mall, the stories of all the people that I represented with stories similar to mine in terms of Latino, in terms of immigrant, in terms of exile, in terms of our LGBT communities, that has always been a grand part of the American story, and that in some ways I had sort of believed that it wasn't, And that might be partly my own prejudice, partly the ways how we perceive what that narrative is through television and through other history books and whatnot, but realizing that America was still this wonderful work in progress, this story that's still not finished, and that we get to, at least in the most ideal sense, we get to contribute each generation, you know, a sentence, a paragraph, a chapter, and that it's a story that keeps on evolving. And it taught me that the incredible sort of those ideals, those American ideals that I was taught to believe in, that they're still there. You know, it's like a mission statement in a nonprofit. Sure, we haven't gotten there, but that's not the point. The point is that each of us has to keep on striving and understanding and growing that narrative and expanding that narrative. And I realized that my role in that moment was so much larger than anything personal, or that it was something so much bigger. And in a way, that's why I wasn't as nervous, because you just felt part of something so much larger than yourself. And the ego sort of took a back seat. But yeah, that was the biggest thing. I suddenly realized, and I keep on trying to say, I'm trying to change my language around that. I'm trying not to say Cuban American anymore, because in a sense, I feel that's somewhat redundant. This immigrant exile story has always been a part of the very fabric of America to begin with, and I don't have to, I'm trying not to qualify those stories anymore. And so if you look at the memoir, to me, part of what the memoir says as a statement is that very idea, right? Here's this little chubby chubby queer kid who grows up in some working class neighborhood behind a bowling alley in some suburb of Miami, works in a Cuban grocery store, and this little boy grows up to be honored in such an amazing way. And in some ways, it's a quintessential American dream, and it makes a statement about that idea that we are part of this story, and that America still, because of its ideals, in some ways still sort of expands and changes. And I think when we see pushback, as we've seen in many issues in the last decade or so, is because there is forward movement. And of course, you're going to get pushback. But anyway, that was the biggest sort of thing. You know, a lot of my work has to deal with the search for home and belonging and identity. And the bottom line was, during the inauguration, moments before I read this poem, or while I'm reading it, I realize I was home all along. Home, in some ways, was in my backyard. This is mine. And I sort of was able to claim America on a very personal and emotional level in a way that I hadn't before.
Well, Richard Blanco, thank you so much for chatting with me.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
That was Richard Blanco, author of the memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. We also featured sounds from the Chicago Humanities Festival and from the PBS NewsHour, and music by Cuban rap artists, Orishas. That's it for Stage and Studio. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes, and don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage-studio. Or tweet us at @StageNStudio. I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for DMA Roberts. Thanks for listening.
¿Entiendes? Me habla el corazón que no me miente, hermano. Flotando, ando, pasando la mano sobre el mapa de este mundo. Y desde lo profundo de mi corazón siento nostalgia. Una extraña sensación como añoranza de esta distancia que se interpone. Que regresaré bien se supone. Y eso me pone el hombre más feliz por un segundo. Ya lo cantó con Pai Segundo. Y yo de nuevo escucho el quejo de mi gente, chico. Bien te lo explico, cubano 100% prototipo.
Me arrancaré el corazón y esperaré mi regreso para sacarlo otra vez y colocar.
muchacho salió por de buena vista a Miramar a la mar. La Victoria, Habana Vieja, Barrio Nuevo, Bejucal. ¿Dónde estás tú, mi rampa? El sol que canta, la catedral, el Capitolio se levanta en el oído de estas voces. 23 y 12, velado, Paseo del Prado, tus leones lado a lado. Forman parte de mis tradiciones, mis emociones, eres tú mi Cuba. Como tú ninguna, cabio, si le soy Yoruba, que no quede duda. Que si lloro es porque le extraño no ver mi malecón a mis amigos de mi zona. Los que nacieron conmigo, los que jugaron conmigo, recordarlos sin tenerlos me hace daño. Año tras año sueño con volver a ver esos amigos que añoraba. Dolor de la campiña cuando llueve el morro, el cañonazo de las nueve.